Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to another week of Fanti, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am entertainment journalist Travell Anderson.
And I am ready to get the fuck up out of here.
Where's here?
Journalist. Listen, this country, this place, this land.
Earth is the ghetto, so.
Listen, we will talk about that a little bit later. I'm journalist and writer Jared Hill. Coming up on the show this week, we are going to be talking about porn and sex work and really the ways that it has influenced us personally and also the culture. But before we get into that, we've got to get into Pass the Popcorn. We've had a shit show of a last week here in this country. We taped the show on Tuesdays. Obviously, Wednesday last week, we witnessed a domestic terrorist attack on our Capitol. And we actually had a lot of conversation about how we would handle that on the show this week. And so because of that, we are actually going to do a special on the next episode about what happened and what it was about. And so we are not doing that this week. That will happen on our next episode. So be standing by for that. My gut tells me by the time we do another episode, it will probably be even more relevant and not less relevant. So we are looking at that. But I have been talking about this so much for the last week and have watched so much coverage and heard so many things that people have had to say about it. I don't know what else there is to say about it. I wrote a piece on Medium about it, and that was titled "We Are Not Better Than This," kind of in response to this conversation around like we are this is not who we are and all that kind of stuff that I see overwhelmingly coming from white people. I just want to say a few things here. Number one, what we saw happen at that Capitol was probably the most perfect depiction of in the modern era, of the difference between being black in this country and being white in this country. We saw really the ways that white people are able to move about this country. Joy Reid put it really well, like white people are not afraid of the police, and that's why they were able to do that. We saw the police officers aiding these terrorists down the steps, holding their hands. The idea that a woman who needed help getting down the stairs felt so comfortable to go burst into the Capitol was just alarming to me. There's a video of a police officer who's being like attacked by these insurrectionists, these terrorists, these people. And he's screaming while his face is being pulled through a door. And I thought that was probably the most perfect image of the difference between being black and being white in this country, because we always hear police officers talk about they shot at said black person that was usually unarmed or running or whatever it is because they were in fear for their life. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this police officer is literally screaming in fear and having his face pulled by a mob of people that are trying to push him through a door. But at no point did he feel like he was in fear for his life enough to be able to do anything about it. And I just thought that was really, really interesting. I have a lot more to say, but I've been talking already. Travell, I'll let you kind of chime in.
What was last week? Wet your whistle. Listen. You know, I think for me, I was watching the clips as it happened, and I just was like, Like that's like I wasn't surprised at their ability to not only gather as much as they did, but to also have the audacity to not only attempt to get into the Capitol, but to also succeed in getting into the Capitol. And I've been hearing BuzzFeed did this really interesting story where they interviewed black officers, like black folks who were part of the Capitol Police people situation, and them talking about like their superiors and their white counterparts not being around. And that struck me as interesting, but not surprising. And it's interesting to see the ways in which folks have, this has finally become the straw that breaks the camel's back as it relates to Trump, as it relates to the unbridled, access empowered and vigilantism that is characteristic of whiteness. And now people feel emboldened. Now they feel like they have a proper excuse to to call into question Trump, to call into question Trump's supporters. That strikes me as an interesting observation. And by interesting, I mean bullshit, to be clear.
One of the things that I pointed out here on the show before is the majority of people who voted for Donald Trump were white, and the majority of white people voted for Donald Trump, right? And so I think it's important that when we look at the people who voted for Donald Trump, you all are people who have heard Donald Trump say what he was going to do, and to some degree been okay with it because you voted for him again. But you've also seen him do what he said he was going to do, right? And that is in myriad different ways, whether it's the Muslim ban, whether it's the trans ban, whether it's the egregious handling of immigrants and their children, whether it's hate for Black and brown people. There is a laundry list of different ways that Donald Trump has told us who he was, what he believed, and what he wanted to do. And like, there's that element of it. But then you are also people who have seen him do the things that he said he was going to do and been okay. And so now we have Republicans who are resigning from the administration.
Cowards.
Or they are, well, right, they're resigning from the administration and in the 11th hour. But it's like, you all have seen him say he was going to do these things, then seen him do these things, and now it's too much. You don't get credit for that, right? Like, you don't get to be able to be able to bring in the conversation about like, oh, well, this just wasn't okay, because we've seen this for 5 years with Donald Trump, because he did it for more than a year before he was actually president. And then yet, after seeing those things, hearing those things, and going through what we've been through just in this last week, last night, on Monday night on Fox News, I was watching, because I used to do this a lot more, where I would watch Fox News to see what the other side of the conversation, what they were feeding people. And I stopped doing that a while ago, but I was really curious about how they were handling it, how they were talking about it. And like, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, they're talking about Hunter Biden and how the Bidens are corrupt and how the election, you know, was questionable and all of these different things. And I'm like, these are the very things that incited that violence. These people should be going to jail too. And so we will talk more about this next week on the show, and unpack it a little bit more. But I'm just kind of at a loss at this point. Like, I don't know what else these white people need.
I mean, last thing I want to say is I just feel like they're doing I call it the Jada Essence Hall at this point. So all my Drag Race girls will know this reference, but it's the look over there, you know? Of it all. And
and they would call it whataboutism in politics, right? Like, they love to say like, well what about
I didn't know that was a term. Thank you for educating me, finally. All right, so we're going
just so you know,
we're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to get into a conversation about sex, about erotica, with one of my good friends, Michael Street.
Let's talk about sex for now, to the people at home or in the crowd. It keeps coming up anyhow.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Ono, Ross, and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
My arm is better.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross, and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm James, host of Minority Corner, which is a
podcast that's all about intersectionality. It's hosted by James with a guest host every week,
discussing all sorts of wonderful issues, nerdy and political,
pop culture,
black queer feminism,
race, sexuality,
news.
You're gonna learn your history, their self-empowerment, and it's told by what feels like your best friend.
Why should someone listen to Minority Corner?
Why not?
Oh my god, free stuff.
There's not free stuff.
The listeners of Minority Corner will enjoy some necessary LOLs, but
but mainly a look at what's happening in our world through a colorful lens.
People will get the perspective of marginalized communities.
I feel heard. I feel seen.
Like you said, you need to understand how to be more proactive in your community, and this is a great way to get started.
Join us every Friday on Max Fun or wherever you get your podcast.
Minority Corner.
Because together, we're the majority.
All right, this week will hopefully be a bit of an escape on Fans High from the insanity of the country burning down around us, as we talked about earlier. We're going to get into that a little bit more next week. Oddly enough, we've talked about doing an episode that focuses on this topic most specifically for a little while now, and somehow we've gotten outreach from multiple listeners recently about wanting to have a conversation about sex, porn, erotica, and our relationship to it. We're diving in nose first and motorboating this one, and we've got a couple of your messages to get us started. Travelle, what did Selena write?
So we have two emails. The first one's from Selena, who writes in part, "I wanted to get into sex positivity with you. I was raised so Christian. I was told porn is one of the worst sins. I am now grown and realize that it's not necessarily like that. It is nuanced. I know you both were raised Christian too. Were you told similar things? And if so, how do you reconcile with it all? How has family sex shaming you affected you?" And then we got a second email maybe a couple weeks later from Jessamine, who writes that they do a lot of work in reproductive justice movement and am really struck by the power of representation, specifically sexual representation, as a means of creating cultural change. They say, "It is my belief and experience that if you do not grow up seeing people who look like you and who fuck like you or like you want to, it can be hard to name and claim sexual pleasure yourself. And this can create huge stigmas around, huge stigmas and barriers surrounding healthy sexual expression. In mainstream pornography, for example, there are tons of wildly racist, transphobic, and otherwise problematic depictions of sex just clicks away. And at the same time, plenty of porn can really be impactful in allowing people to explore new things sexually. And I know that for many queer folks, porn may be the only place where queer sex is being represented at all, given the trash state of most sex ed." And email.
So I had, you know, felt resonated a lot with a lot of what Jessamine was saying there. And I hadn't even thought about that last part about, you know, queer folks not even really being able to see or understand sex outside of porn in many different ways. And I thought that was a really interesting point. We wanted to turn this into a menage a trois of perspectives. So we called in one of the journalists that's doing the hard work and putting the long hours and going deep into the issues. I hate me at this point, so it's fine. He's the digital director for Out Magazine. Welcome to Fanti, Michael Street.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm not even going to say anything about that intro, so
thank you. What do you mean?
I don't mean anything. I'm not saying anything.
Michael, I wanted you to kind of first start off by talking to us, like, how did porn factor into your own sexual discovery, if you will?
Well, I'm gay. So much like we said before, you know, porn was a way for me to see and learn about things, you know, that I couldn't see anywhere else. And so actually, I think I was talking to Travelle about this a few days ago. Porn first came to my life, not as visual form, but like as erotica. There was this old site, nifty.org,
Nifty. I mean, I believe I've heard of that.
Okay.
How you doing?
Very old HTML. Very simple, bare bones. But you know, you read
bareback.
Alive and well and thriving. And so I was like reading the things, and then I think likely probably from there, you know, I think like a lot of gays did. I think I typed in like gay.com and like, you know, just like trying to figure out my way through there. And I think one of the listeners was saying like that she grew up in a Christian household and her family was like very against porn. And I grew up in a Christian household as well. All four of my grandparents were in the ministry. And so, but it's kind of interesting because I was raised in such a household that like my parents didn't have to say you couldn't do things. You just knew. So I don't
You knew what wasn't happening, right.
Listen. And so like, I don't ever remember my parents being like, you can't watch porn. Like that's not for us. But I just knew that I was watching it in secrecy because it was going to be an issue if it wasn't. And so, I mean, I never did the like straight stuff. I knew what I was very young. And and so, I mean, obviously, I think this is a common story. I don't know where I'm going with this, but like, you know, I had that situation of like the girls finding the porn on the family computer, and so there was a lot of that and all of that. So I say all that to say I came to porn at a very young age. I think it was first in middle school and high school, which started with Nifty, so this written form that then turned into photo and video as I got older.
That's so interesting. I'd completely forgotten about Nifty. And now I'm realizing my answer is going to have to include Nifty. Travell, how did porn factor into your own sexual discovery?
You know, when I was a young whippersnapper. Okay. So, you know, actually, I think for me, porn was the... Actually, I take that back.
Did you know we were doing this show today?
Shut your mouth. For me, I've got to give a shout out to Eric Jerome Dickey. To Zane. I feel like those were my first, you know, forays into erotica, into sex, porn, etc. Shouldn't have been reading them things at that age, to be clear, but it is what it is. And then for me, my first, like, any sort of sexual experience was in response to porn. You know, I was one of those girls that, like, you know, I was on LimeWire back in the day. Actually trying to download legitimate music, to be clear. But then you know how, like, some of the stuff back in the day would be named a music track. In the wrong,
yes.
Listen, but it would be, you know, some stuff. Listen, okay?
Do all the girls that are listening, all the people who listen to this show probably know what LimeWire is, right?
I mean, Google is free if they don't.
That part.
There we go. Okay.
And so the first porno video I ever saw was, you know, I had downloaded something that I thought was a music track, but it was a porno. And I was like, interesting. How you doing? You know? And, you know, as the kids say, the rest is history. But similarly to Michael, we didn't talk about sex in the house, but, like, you just knew that wasn't a thing. Also, I was always, you know, effeminate and always, you know, quote-unquote fruity, as the girls used to say back in the day. And so even when I did come of an age where I theoretically might have been having sex, no one breached the conversation with me, although they had done so with my older brother, because he, you know, more stereotypically, you know, carried himself in a way that was like he was out here dipping it and doing it type of stuff. And so, yeah, that for me, I think, is kind of my history. And now I will, you know, proudly say I do believe in supporting the sex workers. And their OnlyFanses.
Generosity.
Well, listen, sex work is work, okay? And they got bills to pay. So, what about... go ahead, Michael, you have something?
I have an aside, because you were mentioning, like, Zane and that stuff. I will say that before Nifty, this is probably going to be very obscure, but my first, like, romance-y kind of sexual thing, I used to read Danielle Steele in middle school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that, I'm 98% sure, predated Nifty. And the reason's because, you know, it's very simple, actually. My family didn't have a lot of money growing up, and so we used to get a lot of things from, like, Salvation Army and other thrift stores like that. And I was a huge reader as a child, and so many books that were there were either John Grisham or Danielle Steele. And I read, you know, one book of each of theirs, fell in love with them. And then it became this thing of me just amassing any book from them that I could get my hands on. And it's funny because my mom, obviously black mother, she's like, oh, you know, he likes to read. You know, I just know these two authors that he likes. And so she would see a Danielle Steele book and buy her for me, and obviously my mother had, I'm sure she still to this day, has no clue what Danielle was writing about.
That you were reading that day is like 50 Shades of Grey situation.
Listen, I mean, but it's also kind of funny to look back and like think about like what Danielle Steele was like really writing, and like today we're like, okay, girl, that's like child's stuff. But at the time, you know, for the white women she was writing for, it was very saucy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for, you know, in middle school me, it was very saucy. So that I just wanted to add that in.
I will say for myself, my first memory of porn is like my cousin was babysitting us, and I think he'd found like my parents' porn and had like his friends over, and like they were like, oh my God, do you see this? But I was like a kid, and I was like, what is happening right now? And so I was like, so like, I had no idea what to do with what I was seeing. And so then, but like, I remembered where they put it, right? And so then like, I was like, oh, well, there's other content here. And so like, I remember that. I don't think I've ever told my parents that. And I'm pretty sure my parents might listen to this anyway. But so that started it. And then I remember like, the book that started for me was Elin Harris's Any Way the Wind Blows.
Oh, yes.
And Basil Henderson, baby! I was like, I was so like, Basil Henderson was like the hottest, sexiest like character or whatever. And then I remember in high school, like Nifty, and I don't remember like where I was finding like video porn, but I do remember Nifty specifically. And like, I remember like printing out stories so I could hide them. And I'm pretty sure my mom found the porn on the computer, but I don't remember specifically. But then over the years, like, it's just kind of evolved, right? And so like, I haven't really been on Nifty a lot, like, in years, but like I do remember it sometimes, and I'm like, oh, I wonder what they're giving, right?
We were on like Michael and I were on Nifty literally 2 days ago.
2 days ago, yeah. I mean, she's very alive.
And like, I mean, it's cool that people can like be creative and write these stories and have a place for them to like go and exist and for people to see them. So that's always been interesting to me. But like, porn has been such an interesting kind of thing, and then like OnlyFans came, and I was like, I started to realize, like, oh, I have always, like, had free porn. And, like, this costs people money. This costs people, like, work, right? Like, this is the work that they do. And so then I was like, oh, I feel like I should be paying for this. And so, mind you, that I have, like, a couple of OnlyFans situations. But I also, like, Twitter, since Tumblr went away, Twitter has been, like, the place to go. Like, because it's all over.
You trying
Twitter,
to tell the people you got a freak Twitter? Is that what you trying to tell
alt.
The people?
I see.
I did not say that at all. Period. So it's just been interesting to find like how it's like evolved over time from like the MyVidsters and the, you know, whatever other .coms that there were. So it's been kind of an interesting process. I want to kind of dig into like, okay, I didn't. Now we just have to be really careful
that.
About
you meant
I didn't do that on purpose.
That one wasn't on purpose.
Y'all the other lying. Ones were on purpose.
This was a setup.
But part of when we get into like the fan and the anti of it all, right? Like the things that we like and the things that we don't. Part of what I appreciate really kind of reaches back to Jessamine's letter saying like it's kind of the place where many queer folks, as she wrote, porn may be the only place where queer sex is being represented at all, given the trash state of most sex ed. And I thought that was so important because I remember like having conversations with my male friends and even my female friends about like porn being the only like frame of reference so many people had for what sex was supposed to be like, right? And like it gives us this idea that sex is supposed to go on for these endless amounts of time. It's supposed to be either really rough or, you know, whatever you're finding in your porn diet. And like, it's been interesting to me to kind of like have the variety and like to discover different things that people are doing and like see what is appealing to me and what's not. Travel, I know that one of your things is just being a visual girl, as you would call it.
Yes. You know, I used to be into reading more so than I am now. And I think once I discovered that video on LimeWire, I was like, okay, I don't have to use my imagination anymore. It's right there, right? And so... and then now, I also will say, it's interesting to also look at porn as a means of storytelling. I might be intellectualizing this a little too much, but like, have you ever looked at one of the professional porns, right? They got a plot, you know, they got a little bit of acting at the beginning, a little acting at the end, quote unquote plot, as Michael just did. but just to see the stories that they sometimes come up with, and the attempts at acting, like some of the girls really be trying to act and get their act on. And I'm not even talking about the little, you know, Atlanta-based YouTube, you know, sexy series. I'm talking about Perna.
What I actually think is really funny when you think about those plots is because we all knew they were fake and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the acting was trash. What I find to be interesting is to think about those in the context of OnlyFans and how you see so many people parroting those same plots with the captions of their OnlyFans videos. And so, you know, they're like spinning this same narrative, right? Because essentially, right, these people have been taught how porn is supposed to be created, that you have to create the storyline. And it's interesting to me to see those people parroting that same, oh, I was walking, well, you know, I ordered this Uber and then I hooked up with the Uber. It's like, girl, we both know you didn't hook up
with the Uber. But you know what, Michael, what's interesting about that? Because I totally see what you're coming from on that. Huh?
Nothing.
What? Did you ask if I've hooked up with my Uber driver?
Yes.
It was a joke. Yes, I have. Okay. Well, I mean,
how you do.
But I think what's interesting about that is, like, it still kind of speaks to, even if it's like a caption on OnlyFans, it still kind of just speaks to like the fantasy of it, right? Because like to me, porn is like, it's a fantasy, right? It's not anything that I'm expecting to happen to me until I hook up with my Uber driver. But like, it's interesting because it still speaks to like the story, right? Like, how did this happen? And like people wanting to like kind of immerse themselves in the idea of that story, kind of like reaching back to the Nifty kind of period of what we talked about at the beginning, right? Like people are intrigued by that, and that's interesting to me.
Michael, I'm wondering, as somebody who covers the sex industry, who covers kink, and you know the leather community and all of those types of things. I'm wondering for you, what stands out to you as something that like you really love, you really appreciate, you really enjoy about this conversation?
I mean, I think that like going back to, I'm not even going to try to say their name, and that is not shade. It's just because I don't want to mess it up. But one of the listeners who wrote, readers who wrote in, they had said, like you were talking about, Jared, about like how porn is also an educational tool. And I think that like it's just, it's really important, as it is an educational tool for everyone, not obviously more so, it's the more marginalized the sex life that you have is, the more important porn becomes, because there's generally a dearth of representation of how you are supposed to have sex and what is safe and what's okay and what to expect and how you, not even what to expect from other people, but how you then behave in a sexual situation, right? And so, I mean, porn can also make people feel comfortable in trying things, right? So you had people a few years ago when OnlyFans and homemade stuff sort of started taking off, you had people trying to do the bait bus idea or like these sort of glory hole ideas, and a man went to jail because, girl, you cannot pretend and then videotape people in secret. That is illegal. And
those
so,
are the girls that always have me fascinated. Like the girls who love the public shit, I'm like, I mean, I get it. It's entertaining, but that's not going to last you forever. Like, you're going to get caught.
It's not even just that. Like, this guy, I'm thinking of a guy specifically. He was, you know, there's these videos of, like, you know, these porn videos of, like, people who, like, secretly tape having sex with people. And that's, like, a genre of actual studio stuff as well. But the issue is that, like, this guy thought that meant that he could do it himself. So he had this whole site and was making a lot of money from it, and he was like, you know, telling these guys that he was a girl and like convincing them to come over and like filming from, you know, his perspective, and then selling these videos on his website, and he got locked up because to create an actual porn, you have to have a release from every person who appears in every scene. And so whether they're pretending they don't know, or you know what I mean? There is a release, girl. And so he got locked up because he didn't have the releases. And so it teaches people how to, what is okay, what is not okay, and how they should expect other people to interact with them and how they interact with others. And so, like I said, the more marginalized, so like fetish and BDSM, it becomes even more important because of the fact that you might not see it anywhere else. So how are you going to learn? And so hopefully you are able to go to a leather bar or meet, you know, a group, a leather club that can teach you those things. But if not, then you're trying to watch porn and thinking that you have to be, you know, what is being represented there, mm-hmm. Which can ultimately be damaging. And so it's really encouraging to hear, for me, to hear about, and I try to spotlight this a little bit in my work, hear about the people who are doing the work and creating porn who have those things in mind, who have the fact in mind that not only are people getting enjoyment from this, but this is also a teaching tool, essentially, telling people how to have sex, you know, what to enjoy, what to expect. And so people who know that and go in knowing that, I think are making some of the best work. And so you have, I haven't been able to write about it yet, but you have a Davey Wavy, who was a YouTuber who everyone sort of know, but he started this porn company. And that is really the whole idea behind it. It's a gay porn company. And the whole idea behind it is we know that people come to it to pleasure themselves, but we also know that people are learning things, and so every video is going to be built around some sort of lesson. So maybe, you know, it's a tantric sex session, or, you know, it's a showing people how to, you know, to give or give a blowjob or, you know, deep throat or whatever they're doing, right? And so there's some people who are just going to watch it because the footage is fab and they need to get where they need to get to. And, you know, this is just going to help them get there. But there's some people who are going to maybe watch it for that and then come back the next day. And it's like, actually, I want to try that. And so they talk you through, you know, these are the ways in which you can do this. Right. And they are also, because of that, very intentional about making sure that there's a diversity of body types and all this sort of stuff, because they know that people need to see themselves and how, you know, I remember, I don't want to get too much into my tea, but like, you know, when I was, I became involved with a trans person for the first time, I didn't know what that was like, or like what that looked like, or what, like anything about it. This is kind of crazy, but like, I had never seen, anyways, I didn't know what was going on.
I don't know why you're bashful now.
In my head I did, but I had never physically seen these things. And so, you know, like, then, you know, everything was fine. It was fab. It was whatever. But then after, I then was like looking for like stuff. I was like, oh, well, like, I want to know, like, did I do something wrong? You know what I mean? And the most logical place to go is to watch porn. And thankfully now, you know, this isn't 2 decades ago. I didn't have to go to studio porn. I could go to the OnlyFans account of trans men. And so it's not, you know, this person performing this way because someone told them to, but this is how this person actually has sex themselves. So it is a teaching tool, and I think that's a really important part of, you know, whether people, it's purposeful or not.
I want to touch on a bit of 2 things that you mentioned. One, I had listed in my fan part, like, I am appreciating, like, the diversity of things that I'm starting to see coming from, whether it be OnlyFans or Twitter or the different places, because I feel like more and more creators are starting to expand, you know, what they include in their content or who they're partnering with or collabing with. But I wanted to ask you specifically, I feel like you covering sex work and the myriad different ways that that shows up is probably educational to a lot of people who read your work. What got you interested in covering it as a beat for your work?
I actually think that my way into it was because I was doing leather BDSM, and so I was integrating myself. And I think even before that, I think that my way into covering leather BDSM was writing about art. And then, like, I think it ended up being slowly like that. And I started going to leather conferences, and then I wanted to cover the conferences. And then I was like, well, I can cover fetish outside of conferences. And then I think it just began to slowly continue expanding. And also because I think that, you know, specifically as a Black gay man myself, like, I think that that terms are the ways in which people interact with us, specifically, you know, white gay men interact with Black gay men in a sexual context, many times is built on what they've seen in porn, mm-hmm. particularly if they didn't have a lot of interactions with Black gay men prior, you know? And so I found it to be really important, the terms in which that are being used in porn, because they then parrot those terms in real life interactions, right? Mm-hmm. And so for those reasons, I think that many industries in many ways are microcosms of the world that we live in. And I think that this is one very specific microcosm that influences how people, you know, have sex. But also, you know, I think for gay men, it also, because for many of us, so much of our identities is tied up within our orientation, that I think that sometimes it influences things outside of that as well.
I think that's a great segue into the anti, because as you were talking about the ways in which porn can be instructive, I thought about the ways in which, you know, folks can also learn the quote unquote wrong things to do because of porn. And that's like one of my, I guess, like antis or like contentions with some porn, is that it does, even for us as queer people, it does teach us some negative things about, like, you know, what to expect in the bedroom, right? And a lot of that, I think, comes from, as you were making the distinction, Michael, from the studio, the more overproduced type porn. But it also manifests itself in some ways in kind of the amateur self-done things as well. I'm thinking just in terms of, like, you know, ideas around protection or lack thereof, ideas around HIV or HIV negative status and HIV positive status, ideas around, you mentioned the whole race play of it all, and you know, the very much the it's just not my preference, no fats no femmes, you know, type of thing that we often see pop up in our communities as well, not to mention the exploitation, the fetishism, the, you know, all of that type of stuff that also pops up in a lot of I think. And this might be more historically than currently, although I imagine it's still there, but, like, you know, the exploitation of sex workers, and who gets paid the top value and who doesn't, you know, top versus bottom, Black versus white, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think what is interesting to me is, like, the way that we see patriarchy play a role in pornography, right? Like, the ways that you know, the top is one thing and the bottom is another. The way that we see men are one thing and women are another. And, like, it's always about, like, the man's pleasure and not about the woman's, if you're looking at straight porn, or the top getting where he needs to go, but, like, the bottom not always getting that. And that's been, like, an interesting thing for me to kind of to witness in porn as well.
Child, the bottom just be laying there busted and bruised, you know, it's all over. And
I mean, you're right. And, like, because one of my antis is that, like, for me, for porn to be good, I need to believe that these people are enjoying it, right? And, like, I find, like, if I don't believe them, I might as well not be watching. Like, what if it doesn't work for me?
So I did want to round back around to sort of, like, the exploitation and who makes the money and who doesn't. It's also really, really interesting because what I say that fan sites, I call them the fan site genre. So that's OnlyFans, Just Her Fans, For My Fans, All The Fans, Her Fans, My all those sites. What I think that they've done really beautifully is they've democratized the industry and put the performers in the positions of power. They make the lion's share of the money. So I think OnlyFans, I believe that you make 80% of what is coming in per month. It's also given them a stability that they've never had. So, you know, previously, you do a film, you know, even at the beginning of the industry, that you do a film, they pay you maybe a big check. Those checks increasingly got smaller, but you got a check, right? You didn't get royalties. You got a check. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of that. The beauty of these fan sites is you create this content, you put it on this thing, it's there forever, and you continue. If some people, even if you don't upload content, some people just have a library of content that their fans will continue to continue subscribing because there's so much old content. So one of the top performers last year, I think it was, not 2020, 2019, he didn't upload new content for like 6 months, and he was still like the top three performer because people just loved his old content, and that would not, he would not have been able to bring in that kind of money prior, right? Mm-hmm. I've talked to some people who were heavily awarded, and also all my sources are gay, so I'm sorry about the straights. I don't really know about that. but he was a heavily awarded.
I've never seen that. I've never heard of that.
I think I've seen maybe a scene, and I was like, you know, this isn't really for me.
That's so interesting. Okay, different conversation, but go on.
Yeah, it's not for me. But so there was a heavily awarded studio performer who, this is at the beginning of the OnlyFans sort of thing. I think this was in 2017. I did my first big feature on it. And we were talking, and he's worked for like every gay studio. And he was like, the money that he was getting, this is maybe his first 3 to 5 months of OnlyFans. He was like, it's so much money that I feel like I'm doing something illegal. Mm. That like, that is how different it is, right? And I know he's making so much more money now. You know, I get emails like somebody's like, oh, well, this person makes $600,000. And like, these are not things that were really plausible before. That said, when we talk about, you know, who has power and who they're, you know, their diversity and that sort of thing, and who they're going after, the reality is that many times they are mimicking the blueprint set for them by studio porn, but now they're in control. But they've been taught what porn looks like by studio porn when they were younger, right? So you see, it's no shade, I'm not going to say any names, you see, you know, Black performers participating in this sort of like, you know, 9 Black tops with this 1 white bottom, right?
Ran through bottom, right.
And so this is, you know, we know this to be one of the most problematic, like, you know, types of tropes that you see in porn. But what people are doing is they know that that made money in studios. And so they're recreating it. Why? Because they're like, these are the things that you do to be successful. And so there is this like really weird thing with that. But I mean, the reality is I was writing a story before we got on, you know, Just for Fans, which is not OnlyFans, but, you know, it is quite a large platform. The girls make quite a lot of money from it. 3 of the top 4 performers for 2020 were Black. So it's, I don't know if you guys know the names, but Max Connor, Raheem Shabazz, and Fat Rabbit Killer are 3 of the top 4, not of the top. They are like, I think they're 1, 2, and 4 of the top performers. And so, you know, I don't know if that would have been plausible or really possible prior for Black gay performers specifically to make so much money, but it's also interesting. I'm wrapping up here. It's interesting to me because this is a story or a book that I want to write at some point about Black gay porn stars. Because it's interesting to me that there's only tops, there's no bottoms, they're not first. And so the names that people really know and that really make the money in gay porn, particularly Black performers, are the tops. So,
which is hard to say
something. I think that says something about, you know, these tropes and these ideas as well.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's hard to divorce whatever success that they're having from those traditional, quote unquote, ideas that folks have about, you know, about Black folks, Black men. Yeah. I'll leave it at that. Go ahead, Jared.
No, I wanted to kind of say that you have in your list here, and I think it's a really good of the anti stuff, like of the impossible standards that porn kind of sets for people. And I wanted you to touch on that.
Well, I mean, I just mean that, like, you know, I also think, I don't remember Never mind, I'm not even going to say that.
no, but say it.
I was going to say, I don't remember the body type of Fat Rabbit Killer, but the body type of Raheem Shabazz and Max Connor, like they're muscular, super muscular, they're super masculine presenting. And the fact that they are, you know, top performers also makes me think about the ways in which, you know, all of the gays want, they want the six-pack abs. They want the nice chest. They want a couple tattoos, not too many. You know, they want these similar types of attributes that those folks have. And I just think about the ways in which, you know, I'm not walking around here with no six-pack, honey. I got that nice little keg over here to keep you warm.
But even that's interesting to me because I found, if we're talking about Raheem Shabazz's work, that like Raheem has started to I'm familiar with the work, has started to like have people of different body types, right? That are a little bit more diverse. And that's been something kind of interesting to me to see. So I've kind of appreciated it. I guess the thing that I would love for us to do before we go, because we're about out of time, Mikel, tell people where they can find out more about the work that you do, where they can see some of the stuff that you've written.
Currently, I'm the digital director of Out Magazine, and so I don't do as much of the sort of in-depth reporting, like writing, as I used to. And so I am hoping to get back into that. Like I said, I'm doing this really quick news story right now about the top performers, and I hope to do some bigger stories. But my like Twitter account is Mikel D Street. I have no followers because I got banned.
Wow.
Yeah. So
see, you were doing freak shit on Twitter, and that's,
no, I was not.
That's what's gonna get you in trouble.
I trolled Fox News, and they did not like it, and they kicked me off of Twitter. So
there's that.
You were doing the Lord's work. Trump. It's okay.
I was, and so, but on my website, MikelStreet.com, I do have a page, I think called Sex/Fetish, that encapsulates what I feel are some of my biggest pieces about sex and fetish. And so there's a little bit of that stuff there. And otherwise, I mean, I hope to continue doing some pieces, but those are probably the best places.
I also want to say for the folks out there that you need to follow Mikel, because Mikel is one of the, I'm going to say, one of the preeminent
she's scary.
One of the preeminent historians of ballroom. And does really great reporting around ballroom, voguing, Kiki scene, all of them motherfuckers.
Where you learn Kiki scene from?
Girl, I know the things. Don't worry.
Wow. While you two fight, I'm gonna let the people go to a break. we want to know what you all think about this, though. Make sure you hit us up on Twitter or Instagram at Fantai Podcast, and let us know what you think about porn. What do you love about it? What do you hate about it? What did we miss in our conversation? At Fantai Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you, Mikel. Fantai's coming back.
Okay, beautiful people, every new year, we all hear new year, new me, and that usually means you'll be picking up better habits, trying new things. Maybe you're going to the gym. Well, actually, don't go to the gym now. We're still in the middle of a photosynthesis, okay? But if you do take up a new hobby, it's even better when you have amazing audio to make that experience just, you know, sing, if you will. You can do that with wireless earbuds from Raycon. Whether it's following along to directions in the kitchen, bringing an audiobook along while learning to knit, or powering through a new workout with a pumped up playlist in your ears, a pair of Raycons can make any activity easier and a better time. They're wireless earbuds that start at half the price of other premium audio brands, and they don't just look great, they perform wherever you take them. With up to 6 hours of playtime, they're water and sweat resistant for all y'all out there who got sweaty earlobes and stuff, and they Bluetooth pair with your device quickly and seamlessly.
And Raycon's offering 15% off all their products for our listeners. And here's what you had to do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/fantai. That's it. You'll get 15% off your entire Raycon order. So feel free to grab a pair and a spare. That's 15% off at buyraycon.com/fantai. That's buyraycon.com/fantai.
Welcome back, beautiful people. We're going to get into our listener feedback, your opportunity to give us some of your thoughts about our conversations on the show. And this week's email comes from Kristen in response to last week's episode with Sharon Smith Kinsanya, all about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And Kristen said that she thought that the conversation, missing from the conversation, was how many of us, Black folks, colored folks, etc., many of us not in upper level leadership roles get pulled into committees sometimes called DEI or under the employee resource group umbrella and asked to contribute to solving the diversity issue, quote unquote, but without a budget, training resources, let alone compensation and time to do work outside of our job descriptions. Sometimes there's a DEI officer, sometimes there isn't. She tells us about her experience getting pulled into an ERG, an employee resource group, at her company. And she's noted that she sees organizations using such language, like they slap images of PLC folks on their print and web materials, but it's not followed by actions or dollars. Without any real training or leadership, diversity efforts then become window dressing and not looking at what it takes to recruit and retain people of color at all levels. Let me be clear, this isn't DEI, but rather the language that has been appropriated to create a woke veneer. I thought that was, I think we grazed over it in our conversation about the ways in which folks who aren't DEI experts get called in to do that type of work. But I wanted to share this specific experience to nail down on the ways, right, folks get called to do this work and aren't paid to do it.
I would say that I think the piece that we did talk about last week was how being Black does not make you a diversity and inclusion expert. And so often Black folks are expected to come in and do that work because they're Black, as if like there's no training or experience or knowledge that kind of comes into that. But also I think, go ahead.
No, I just also wanted to add this part from Kristen's email. She says she had to decide at one point that unless she was provided training and compensation to contribute to the diversity efforts in her company, that she would step back from participating because just being the only Black woman was exhausting enough already. She says, I am not trained and it is not my spiritual gift. That part.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's an important part of it, because I remember in June when every company had a Black Lives Matter statement, I remember talking with some different friends about how companies that they worked with or around or were a part of, or different organizations or what have you, were trying to like go out and farm out what their language should be like with consultants and journalists and comms people and da-da-da. And it was like, if you guys don't have the capacity within your organization or your company to figure out what that language is, you probably need to be doing some other work before you're putting out a statement, right? You probably need to be doing some analyzation around what your organization looks like or your company before you start digging into making sure that you have the right statement, because you probably haven't done the work to be having that conversation yet. So thank you so much, Kristen, for that letter. We appreciate it. It's time for us to move into dishonorable mentions. These are the stories of people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out, either for their good or for their stupid. I'm going to start off by giving an honorable mention to whomever started the hashtag no fly list. My friends in the group chat have been sending us sending like different tweets into the hashtag, into our group chat. The no fly list hashtag is basically all of the domestic terrorists who are getting like pulled off of planes or stopped at the airport and being told that they're on a no fly list because they're designated as terrorists. I didn't think I would want to see video of that until I started watching it. And I was like, this is such a treat. This is such a gift. And like, I have enjoyed it way more than I thought I would.
Speaking of, foolish people, one of my dishonorable mentions goes.
Wait, was that at me?
No.
Okay.
Why would it be at you?
Because it's you.
Wow. But I love you, Jared.
Oh, okay. We'll go with that.
I would never.
This is where shady editor Jordan, I'm not expecting her to do this, would go back and pull in all of the shady things that you said. Wow. And like put them in if this were like the Real Housewives of Atlanta.
Very that. My dishonorable mention goes to over the weekend, or maybe late last week, we saw the interview between Gail King and Mia Ponsetto, aka Soho Karen. She's the woman who accused, I believe, a 14-year-old Black teen of stealing her phone at a hotel, I believe, in New York City. And she literally attacked this little child, thinking that he stole the phone, and he did not, to be clear. And the phone was actually discovered at the hotel, the desk people in the hotel, whatever you call them people. But the interview that she does with there's a moment in the interview with Gayle King where she does that white woman thing. I don't even think she's white, but she does that white woman thing where she tries to talk over and tries to she does this little hand motion toward Gayle King. You don't talk to Gayle King like that, honey. Okay?
Baby, that hand. Woo! Listen. I was feeling a way when she put up that hand and was like, okay, Gayle, I get it. I was like,
it was
I know you fucking lying. It was. Okay, I want to give my second honorable mention to who I believe is Nikki Aaliyah on Instagram. Nikki actually put out this song a few weeks ago on Instagram, and over the last week it has really kind of blown up. Her song is called Earth is Ghetto, and it's been like remixed by multiple different people now. This is a snippet of what that sounds like, one of the remixes of them that she posted.
You should see these people, it's hard to believe how they treat each other. It's hard to conceive, oh, Earth is ghetto. I wanna leave, oh, Earth is ghetto. I wanna leave. I wanna leave.
Okay, so the idea that she wrote a song to aliens saying, come get me because this shit out here ain't hitting, that took me out. Like, I deeply have been relatable. Walking around. Listen, relatable content, right? Like, I've been walking around humming, Earth is ghetto, like, just for a week now. It's been a delight. So, shout out to Nikki Aaliyah. I'm saying your name correctly.
Yeah, I hope I'm gonna give a passing honorable mention to Eric Jerome Dickey. I mentioned him briefly in our fan tie portion, but he recently died. Sending love and peace and all of that to his family and those affected by it. I wanted to give an honorable mention to Eugene Goodman. We spoke at the top of the show about the foolishness that took place at the Capitol, and Eugene Goodman. I don't know if you all have seen, but there's one photo in particular of a black man, like, in the hallways at the Senate. He's basically credited as being, like, the guy who, quote-unquote, saved the Senate. So I just wanted to shout him out, lift him up. Where was his Cash App? Send him some extra coins. Listen. For putting his body on the line. Now, we will talk at a different point about him being a cop. You know,
I think there's an episode in Black Police Officers. I think there's an episode in there. One of the things that I loved about Eugene's story was they were saying that, I don't know if he did this intentionally or not, but they were like, it was one of the hardest videos to watch of like a black police officer with all these Blue Lives Matter people, right? That are like chasing him. And they said that there was a moment where he started going and they were moving him closer and closer to the Senate, but like he started moving a different direction that was actually away from the Senate, that probably ended up saving their lives, the senator's life. So yeah, I love that you did that. That's great. My last honorable mention is going to go to Brian Williams. Brian is, I think, a national treasure, mind you, not without controversy.
Ain't he the one who had misremembered the situation?
You don't have
I'm
to
just
do that.
Saying, because every time necessary. I see him on my TV, I'd be like, interesting.
You done?
Yes. I just had to say it. I'm just saying.
You did. Listen, we get it. Their hair is blue. Okay. Thank you. But I think Brian Williams, again, not without controversy, is a national treasure and one of the best anchors that there is on television. And I think that part of what I love from him is his sense of humor. This is him on Monday night discussing something that happened at the State Department.
One other item that caught our attention during today's push to get Trump to resign. A State Department website featuring the president's biography suddenly changed this afternoon to read simply, Donald J. Trump's term ended on January 11th, 2021. There are reports a disgruntled employee at the State Department was responsible. Certainly doesn't appear to be the work of the gruntled.
So that actually set me to go look. First of all, I was like, is gruntled even a word? And apparently it is. So I appreciated that. But I cackled at that. And I wanted to give him this honorable mention because, I mean, his name has been dragged through the mud quite a bit. And I think that he is just a stellar anchor who fucked up and has really had a great resurgence on MSNBC on the 11th hour and is doing really great work. And I appreciate a good dad joke because I can be corny like that. So
Yes, you can. My last mention, I just saw this headline pass my Twitter feed right before we came in to record. And the headline is, to help heal racial wounds, U.S. Representative Jim Clyburn is pushing to make Lift Every Voice and Sing America's national hymn.
That's from your home state.
Oh, you ain't got to tell me about the backwards ass motherfuckers. But this is one of those situations where...
No, like, Jim Clyburn is from your state. He's a representative from your state.
Oh, no. And that's what I'm saying. I find this decision... who asked for this? All of the stuff we asked for, and you decide that you want the Negro national anthem to be America's national hymn.
Oh, you're upset about this.
I'm confusion, yes.
You're confusioned. Okay.
And I just, it's another thing of like, you know, politicians in particular, leaders more broadly speaking, coming up with these efforts that they assume or think will be received well, I guess, maybe, I don't know. But it's just like, come on, Clyburn, you could have put your energy behind something else. And I'm sure he is putting his energy behind other stuff as well. Let me be clear.
From what I understand, this isn't the only initiative he's working on.
I'm sure it's not. And it better not be, right? But this one in particular, I was just like, I just was like,
I'm here for it. I mean,
I don't know that. You're here for everything, goddammit.
Am I? Is that true?
Most things.
I didn't think so. I would say that I don't know that it's going to help heal the nation, because I know as soon as it's played somewhere and I see a white person taking a knee, I'm going to be ready to cuss.
You want to know what should be America's national hymn?
I feel like it's going to be Ratchet.
We knocking and bucking and ready to fight.
I knew it was going to be some bullshit. As we wrap up, in preparation for next week's episode, we think that it'd be interesting for you to go back and check out our episode Tired with Dr. Joy DeGruy. It really speaks to this moment in a way that, you know, we couldn't have ever planned on, but it speaks to the moment of where we are in America. The episode is called Tired. It's from our June episodes, and you can check that one out right now. We ask that if you are a listener of the show and you check us out on Apple Podcasts, please make sure to go give us a 5-star rating and a review. Let us know what you think about the show. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, you can tweet at us or hit us up on Instagram at Fanti Podcast on both of those. And in the conversation, make sure to use hashtag FantiFam to let us see where you guys all are in the conversation, and we can jump in there.
And if you'd like to support this good that we give you every single week, you can become a member of the Maximum Fun family and the Fanti fam at MaximumFun.org/join. And as always, you can email us at Fanti@MaximumFun.org.
Our music is by Corice. You can find him wherever you find Slay Worthy Audio. That is Corece. Our graphics and video are from Ashley Wynn. You can check her out on social media at I Am Ash Wynn. And our producers this week are you ready? Jordan Cowley!
I'm a smart, strong, sensual woman.
Oh, God.
And Laura Swisher!
I'm working on some erotic holiday fiction.
This is a production of Maximum Fun.
Ew.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
What happened?
I'm sorry. It's been a long day.
Jordan's like, something else for me to cut out. Okay.